My name is David Walker with Fire Iron Forge.
Good day, and I'm Lando of Abstract Blacksmith, coming into Forgeside Chat here, podcast about blacksmithing, bladesmithing, and everything in between. With heavy focus on talent in the Great White North. We're not quite coming into the Great White North once again. Sorry about that, everybody. You know, it's our focus is supposed to be Canada, eh? But we're hitting North Idaho today with David from Fire and Forge, like you heard. David's in his early 40s. He's been doing this since he's a little kid, you guys. He didn't get really serious until he was about in his 20s at some point. So it's about 15 years now, he figures, that he's been super serious about blacksmithing, mainly instructing. This guy does classes, knife making, artistic. He loves his sculpture, specifically kinesthetic sculpture, which if you know anything about that in the blacksmithing realm, it can get really difficult to find your balances with all your pieces, making things move without the use of bearings and stuff like that. We'll hopefully pop into that a little bit and hear a little bit more about that. But one of the main things we really want to bring up on this episode, you guys, is Abana. Abana has their 50th anniversary coming up. It's June 6th to 9th, and that's going to be happening in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. The 50th anniversary, guys, is going to be huge. There's going to be a lot of focus on a lot of different aspects of blacksmithing, education, knife making. There's going to be a team forging competition going on, which David can really talk to us about because he's involved in the planning of that competition itself. There's going to be other educational tents around for everybody of different levels of blacksmithing. So it's a really awesome opportunity for you guys to up your game. There's not a better way. Like literally, if I've been blacksmithing now for say 7-8 years now, I've been in this game, there is not a better way to up your game than going and having an in-person event with other blacksmiths where you get to talk, meet and greet all these different people that maybe you've looked up to for a long time. Maybe you don't even know who some of these, you might get to meet somebody that has been an amazing blacksmith for years, and you have no idea. You'll shake this person's hands, have a conversation with it, and look back in future years and go like, oh my God, I just stood there and talked to Mark Asprey. I had no idea that was, or somebody of that. You know, there's going to be amazing people there. You can't, David, what else can I say about this event? It's going to be great. Tell me more about it, man.
It's going to be super awesome, man. We're all really pumped about it. It's the 50th anniversary, so we are literally like going above and beyond any other conference that I know of in Abana's history. So we're pulling out all the stops. We have a whole educational section where, as you said, Mark Asprey is going to be there along with some other fantastic instructors. They're going to be doing some great stuff with the national curriculum to help everybody push themselves and continue to grow as a blacksmith. We're going to have demos from instructors all over the world, a whole bunch, I mean, too many to list, but some really, really good ones are going to be out there throughout the whole conference. And then the competition is another big part of it. That's kind of something that that they've put me in charge of. So putting together that, trying to get some competitors from all over the world. And we do. We have people that are coming internationally to compete. So it should be really fun, man. I'm really excited.
This is like, you got to look forward to going to an event like this. Get ready to it. Do a lot of planning ahead of time so that you're not caught with your pants down. Get your flights in check. Get your hotels in check. Johnstown has a lot of places for accommodation, though. This is a place that is prepared for an event like this. You can go there and you can see a lot of the other things that are involved in Johnstown. This is the center of steel, you guys. Johnstown's known as Steel Town. Like, there's a lot to see there. You can go just check out the Center for Metal Arts. Is that the name of it, right? Center of Metal Arts?
Yeah.
With Pat Quinn. Metal Arts
with Pat Quinn. Yeah. Yeah, he's going to be there. We had a meeting for Abana back in November, and I was able to fly out a couple days early to go meet Pat in person. And I go, hey, man, you know, can we do a class, you know, kind of, you know, a la carte? And he was really happy to oblige. So got to spend a couple days with him doing some power hammer classes, and it was brilliant. Absolutely love it. I mean, it's just, it's a amazing facility too. If people have never been or seen CMA, it's outstanding. They have some of the biggest power hammers I've ever seen in person. You know, like you see some of those huge ones that they have like overseas, like in China and stuff like that for huge industrial forging. And they have some of them there and they use them to forge anvils, you know, like 200-pound anvils they're making on these power hammers. It's incredible.
That is incredible, man. Oh my dear Lord. That is something I would love to see. And I want to know a little bit more about you though, man. We've been talking about Abana here for the first little bit, man. Let's hop on to you though, dude. This is why I brought you on. I want to know about you. I mean, I do want to know more about Abana too. We'll hop back and forth all over the place, but I want to know about you, man. Sure. Where did this start for you, man? You were, as a little kid, you got into blacksmithing. Like that's awesome. You got to start way back as a little kid. What was it? How did you do it?
Yeah, no, it's funny. So nobody in my family was a blacksmith or anything like that. I grew up in the 80s. And so in the mid to late 80s and even the early 90s, there was a lot of TV shows and movies and stuff that I liked that had some blacksmithing in it. And I thought it was cool. Like they had the Conan the Barbarian and the original Highlander movie. Yeah. And then and even like the Ninja Turtles were cool. When I was a kid, but I was all into like weapons and martial arts and all that kind of stuff. And so my mom and I were out camping one time and I was probably like 6 or 7. And anyhow, we're sitting around a campfire and we had some coat hangers for cooking hot dogs and s'mores and stuff. And mom was off kind of doing something else. I don't know why, but I was real secretive about this. I was going to get in trouble or something, but I take the coat hanger and I put it in the coal for the coals for the fire because it's glowing, you know, like it is in the movies and the TV shows and stuff. I go, hey, if I put this metal in there, I wonder if I can get the metal to glow, you know, like it is where the coals are. So sure enough, you know, it's a real thin piece of metal. It's not the best quality. And put it in there for a little bit, take it out, and it was glowing, you know, just like I had seen elsewhere. And I just thought that was super cool. And then we had rocks kind of piled, you know, around the campfire or whatever. And I'm like trying to be real sneaky about this. And I really don't know why. Mom was off. And anyhow, so I go and I take the metal out and, you know, kind of start smashing it together on another rock. And it totally smushed out flat. Again, it's really thin, not very good quality steel, or even if it is steel. But I just thought that was the coolest thing I had ever seen because it was metal and I got it to glow. And then I was able to squish it flat just like they did, you know, right, in the movies and stuff like that. So that kind of led me down this path of really not so much forging, but more weapon making. So, you know, I didn't have a forge or anything like that as a kid or access to it. But I had a grandfather that had a workshop and he had like a bunch of hammers and a bench grinder and stuff like that. At the time, we were living in Southern California and he had a lot of bamboo that he had on his property. So it was like we were making blowguns and nunchucks and all kinds of stuff with like nails and spikes and throwing stars and all kinds of goofy stuff. And then that kind of led into weapons. And I started collecting weapons like really young and like real legit weapons. They weren't like stuff that you'd get off of like wish.com, you know, or whatever. Like I had real like katanas. I had real size and ninja stars. We had a competition that we had or a talent show that we had in fourth grade that I did where I brought in nunchucks that I just taught myself. Just super fun. Looking back on it now, I kind of like, Mom, like, what are you thinking? Like, I had all these crazy, like, very serious weapons as a really young kid, but I loved them. I loved martial arts and I loved kind of weapons from that era, from like Asia and Japan. And then also like medieval, you know, knights and swords and shields. I mean, all that kind of stuff. We would go to medieval times and see all that kind of stuff. I just loved all of that. And so that's what I did a lot as far as when I was a kid. When I got a little older, you know, like junior high, high school age, kind of everything in my world kind of got replaced with an interest in girls and snowboarding.
That was no way. You too.
Yeah, that was kind of my life in junior high and high school. And then, yeah, shortly after high school, I ended up getting married. And then I really wanted to kind of go back to that moment at that campfire when I was a kid, you know, go back to trying to do blacksmithing, you know, as a big adult in my early 20s, thinking I had it all sorted out. But I had no idea. I didn't know what I didn't know. And so I just started trying to figure stuff out. And what I ended up doing was I took a cinder block. So a cinder block, if you're not familiar, it has kind of two holes through right. it. And so I packed one side in really good with mud. So it kind of made like a little cave. And then we had a weed burner. Mm-hmm. And so I got the weed burner, put like little nails and bolts, you know, little stuff that we had in the garage, you know, up with this weed burner. And then I found out somewhere that you could use a piece of railroad track as like a makeshift anvil. And so I was able to find one of those online, something like that, like Craigslist. Like the internet existed when I was doing this, but it was nothing like it is today. Like YouTube was like people's home videos for like their vacations, stuff like that. There were some forums. There was a couple of blacksmithing forums, and that's where I found out that you could use a railroad track. So I had the railroad track just sitting on the ground. I had a little towel that I rolled up for my knees. I was sitting in an office chair that I drug into the garage in the stupid weed burner. I had a claw hammer. It didn't have a waffle face. It was smooth, but it was just a claw hammer. And then I used a pair of pliers, tongs, and sat there, you know, in the office chair and just blasted this tiny little piece of metal in this little cinder block forge type thing that I made. You know, and it barely got orange. I mean, just barely. And it's really thin metal. But, you know, it's glowing enough for me. And so I'd set the weed burner off to the side, grab the pliers, you know, grab the steel, and then start hitting the stupid anvil or the railroad track. And because it's all on the ground, like nothing's mounted. So you hit the railroad track and it moves.
It's moving, yeah.
Right, yeah. As you continue to hit it, it moves like to where it's too far away. You can't physically get to it anymore. But the steel was so small, you know, it was like it was fine. So we'll just take it and put it back in the quote-unquote forge, you know, and kind of reset everything where everything goes, pop back in the office chair and blast the crap out of the steel again. And I loved that. That was, oh, dude, that was so much fun. I had a blast doing that, and I wouldn't shut up about it. And so anyhow, I was talking to a guy at church about it, and he goes, he's a farrier, oh, and he goes, "You're doing what in your garage?" You know, he's trying to like make sense of it. He goes, "What are you doing?" And I go, "Oh, dude, it's the coolest thing. Like, you should come over and check it out." And he was like, he goes, "I have a little riveter's forge on the side of my house that's just sitting outside. You know, like I got an extra bucket of coal. You can just have the coal. And, you know, I'll bring the other thing over, nice. Borrow this until you can get a proper, you know, a proper setup." And so he comes over and gives me the coal forge or whatever, shows me how to light it up. And it was like magic all over again. Like I was totally excited and thrilled to be forging stuff on the ground, you know, with the stupid weed burner. But it was like, oh, now the metal actually gets hot. And I know that. So got hooked up with that from him. And then, eventually got the railroad track mounted on a stump. And dude, I made stuff on that little setup for almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. How my family and I kind of set up our finances is if you have like a side hustle kind of thing, that's, you know, like an extra thing that's different from your regular job, then that's kind of separate from our family finances. So I was like, all right, I'm going to take this hobby with benefits and I'm going to make some money at it and then use it to, you know, to buy better stuff, to buy new stuff. And so that's what I did. I ended up making a bunch of knives that way. And then selling those knives and then kept doing that. Yeah. It was almost about 2 years, before I was able to finally save up enough to get like a proper anvil. And then it was like that moment, you know, all over again. I'm just like, oh man, you know, like this is amazing, going to, from a little railroad track to an anvil. And that just kind of kept going, man. And that it still is kind of going that way till today. we just have a blacksmith school now. And, you know, now we're getting power hammers and hydraulic presses and induction forges and, you know, all kinds of other cool stuff.
The scale has changed a little, eh?
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit, a little bit.
This is awesome that you bring this up, because I just posted about this on one of the Facebook groups recently. This conversation essentially comes up quite a bit on the podcast about where you started, what you started with. Do you think it was beneficial for you to start at that level versus, say, had that farrier given you a 200-pound anvil and a nice propane forge and a few hammers and some nice tongs and, you know, a few pieces of steel, all the doodads that kind of really would have got you set up right off the hop? Had that all been given to you, do you think that same level of excitement to continue on Would that have been there, or would have it been different?
You know, I don't know if the excitement would have changed as much, because I was so thrilled, you know, just whatever I could do to get metal hot and start, you know, forging stuff. But I definitely think it would have done me a disservice as far as learning and appreciation. You know, like if somebody gave you a brand new car that was a really nice car, you know, that was what you learned how to drive on, you're kind of spoiled a little bit in a lot of senses. You know, like if you have kind of a dumpy little car, you know, when you're first learning how to drive and, you scratch it up here and ding it up a little bit there or whatever, because you're kind of learning how it drives and, you know, it doesn't maybe get the best gas mileage or whatever. There's a lot of stuff that you learn in that process. You know, like I didn't have any tongs. And so one of the very first things that I made without knowing how was a pair of tongs to go, okay, hey, I'm going to be forging stuff. I need something other than pliers. And so I remember just looking at the pliers that I did have really carefully and going, okay, I just need to try to replicate this with just longer handles. And so that's what I did. And I made them out of rebar. Actually, I still have, I still have the same pair. And because I love to teach, I had invited some guys from church to come over to check out, you know, the shop, you know, with this this new forge that this buddy had let me borrow. And I still was on the railroad track at that time. But that was the first thing that I ever taught a group of people was tongs. Where they go, hey, you know, if you guys are going to forge, you're going to need to hold the steel. So this is one of the first things you're going to learn is how to make tongs. And so that's what I would teach people is how to make tongs. But yeah, it was nice because every time something got better, and I got better tools or better equipment, you know, you appreciate it that much more. Mm-hmm. You know, like the first grinder that I had when I was making knives was like a little Harbor Freight anvil. It's, you know, like a 3 or 4 inch wide by 36 inch belt, something like that. They're not bad little grinders or little sanders. But yeah, going from that to like a 2x72 or even a 2x42 is such a huge difference. Not even with a VFD, you know, just something that's more than, you know, a third of a horsepower motor. you really, really appreciate that when you get there, you know. Yeah. And it pushes you to really, I don't know, to try hard to do what you need to do to sort it out. Like a lot of times as a teacher, I have people that will ask me online and in person, they'll go, hey, you know, what, you know, if I really want to learn how to forge, what is it that I need? You know, what do I really need to do to get started? Mm-hmm. And they're usually mm-hmm. asking about equipment. And the equipment, it's not that it's irrelevant, but the most important thing that anybody needs to really learn how to forge or learn how to do blacksmithing or bladesmithing really is just the desire. You know, the desire to do it is going to help you figure out whatever you need to figure out to make it happen. You know, like there's people in other countries that don't have, you know, quite the blessings that we have here, you know, that are forging good stuff on large sledgehammers that they're using that buried in the dirt as an anvil. You know, and they're sitting there on the ground, you know, with a little fire they have next to them, and they're making stuff that's not bad. And they're figuring it out.
Yes.
A 5 to 10 pound sledgehammer they have partially buried in the dirt. You know, so that will to do it is the, I think, the most important thing that anybody can have as far as really what they need. Because if you have that, you'll do like what I did or what like a number of other people have done. Is you figure it out, you know, you just get started forging however you can. And then as you go, you know, try to make it better. Like I started making knives, which I was really excited about when I first started, because I loved weapons. Again, it was kind of that whole thing from my childhood. And when I really started making knives, at least a little bit more properly, I was bummed because I started really not liking it. It was really unpleasant. What I was discovering is that there wasn't a whole lot of forging, you know, like only 30% or so of the time actually making the knife was at the anvil. Everything else, I was doing stuff with wood and epoxy and then pins and the drill press, grinder, and then hand sanding. And then, you know, then you need a sheath. So now I'm doing stuff with Kydex or leather. And, you know, it was like, there's all this other stuff that was still cool, but it wasn't what I really enjoyed. What I really loved was the forging. I really loved being at the anvil. So I kept making knives to sell them, you know, just to fund the hobby, to fund the addiction. But yeah, I remember there was like 2 weeks where I was all depressed. I was like, well, if I can't make a sword, if I can't make if I'm not going to make knives, you know, like what else is there? I have this setup now that I was super excited about, and now I'm actually, you know, making stuff, and I didn't like it. And it was just like, oh, well, what else could I possibly do? And that sent me back online to some of those forums, and it was just like, oh, dude, like there's tons and tons of like anything else you can think of that's made out of metal, from sewing needles to hammers to axes, you know, all kinds of super cool stuff and sculptures and yeah, you name it. And it's all there. So yeah, that's kind of, yeah, how all of that, that kind of came to be.
You touched on a few things there that I'd like to bounce back onto. One of the main things that I'd like to really touch back on is that level of stepping up your game, where you're talking about, you know, when you're ready to progress from that 1/3 horse motor up to the new and fancy schmancy 2x72 grinder, maybe one from Broadbeck Ironworks, which you can get at maritimeknifesupply.ca. You can also get Paragon and Even Heat Kilns from maritimeknifesupply.ca.com. You can use the code FSCKILN at checkout. You'll save yourself $100 on one of those kilns. And there is not a better way. Well, like we were talking about earlier, the Abana conferences are really a great way to step up your game. But the next best way, if not the best way to step up your game in conjunction with that, is your equipment. Step up your equipment. Maritime Knife Supply has it all, from belts, belt grinders, Even Heat Kilns and Paragon Kilns. You can get yourself all the different supplies you need for knife material, as in your blade stock, your pins, your handle material. This guy literally stocks everything. And if he doesn't, just send him a message. He'll probably be able to get it to you, and he'll get it to you faster than anybody else out there. I don't know how he does it. We've talked about this before. Brian House brings it up. Every other podcast that this guy's in conjunction with brings it up. It's crazy. It doesn't make sense how fast he does it. And it's awesome. I love you, Lawrence. Thank you so much for everything you do for the community. That's at maritimeknifesupply.ca. Now, back to the other thing that I wanted to bring up. You mentioned about that starting with nothing and how it's kind of, it puts you in a position of having to learn, having to realize there are things you can do to make this work. You don't need to have that 200-pound anvil. You can start with a sledge. You can work for the rest of your life on a sledgehammer anvil if you want to, right? There's guys that do it. But there's also a level, you mentioned, you know, starting off with the crappy car, not being spoiled, essentially. This comes up. I've been listening to another podcast quite heavily. In fact, I burned through every episode in a week, which is like, I can't believe how much I listened to this podcast, and I just soaked it up. I'm super hungry for this guy and more if I can. I'm talking about Mark Manson, the author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. He also writes another book called Everything is Fucked. This guy, in my opinion, has it figured out. There is some things about it that you can look at and maybe disagree with him. It depends on your take on religion. That can be a huge one where you disagree with him, because he has his views on religion, and everybody has a different view on religion. But aside from that, one of the things that he really brings up is being spoiled and how that can really affect your growth curve in life, and how that affects you psychologically. And that is really what stemmed to my question on Facebook about where you start. Does it matter if you start with these little items or work your way up? And man, there is so much. I really would like to bring Mark Manson on as a guest to the podcast, not because he's a blacksmith, but because the things he talks about falls so directly in line with our mentality as makers and our our understanding of having to keep busy with our hands in order to stay happy. We have found our happy spot by keeping, there's so many people in our industry of blacksmithing that are doing it specifically to stay happy. That is why they're doing it, right? Like, heaven forbid I found something that I'm passionate about and it makes me happy. Thank God for that, right? Like, oh my goodness. So I highly suggest to anybody that is a listener of the podcast, that is a fan of blacksmithing, go and check out Mark Manson's work, his podcast. If you're not a book reader, I'm not much of a book reader. It takes me forever to read a bloody book, but his podcast is spot on. He's also got talks on YouTube. You can go watch his talks on YouTube. The guy's really got some amazing takes when it comes to psychological stuff and how that all works in conjunction to what we do as makers. So back to Abana, dude, a little bit. You're working on the Team Forging event, which is pretty cool because that's like your main thing is teaching. Like, you love to teach, and now you're putting together this team forging event, which I'm sure there's coming from the teacher background, there's a lot you can take into that, to the planning aspects that you go, like, as a teacher, I understand that these groups of people need to be doing these different things at these different times in order for this to work. Let's dive into that, man. Tell me a little bit more about this team forging event and how it's working, man.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's super cool. We're really, really excited about it. You know, I'm also a little bit nervous about it. You know, Abana hasn't done a competition like this in a long time. But there's an organization that does a competition in Italy. They bring competitors from all over the world. I believe it's in the town or of Stia.
Right.
I think that's how you pronounce it. I hope so.
Yeah, I believe so. That's how I've heard it pronounced.
Yeah, so they do some great competitions out there. So we didn't want to try to replicate that, but we did kind of use that as a general frame to kind of build our take on that. So you can compete as an individual if you wanted to, and then you can have up to four people as a team. So you can go from one to four smiths, and then everybody will have a four-hour time slot to forge really whatever you want. There's a theme, which is Abana's 50 years of forging, and that's really it. There's going to be a bunch of different steel that's going to be provided in different sizes and lengths that you can cut ahead of time, so you can kind of prep your steel, so that stuff should be ready to go. Everybody's going to be forging out of coal forges, so you'll have unlimited coal to use. One of the things that that we're doing is that we're trying to figure out how to keep the competition as fair as possible. So one of the things that we've done is we've limited the tools that people can use. Mm-hmm. So the limitation on the tools is by weight. So you can bring whatever tools that you like, with the exception of they can't have any moving parts. So you can't bring a spring swage. You can't bring like a blacksmith's helper or a smith and magician or something like that. But you can bring like, you know, your normal hardy tools, top tools, hammers and tongs, if that's something that you'd like to bring. We're going to supply all kind of the general tongs that will hold the stock that we're going to have. And then we're also supplying hammers, you know, ranging from that 2-pound range up to an 8-pound sledge. They're going to be ball peen, cross peen, and rounding hammers available to everybody. Every team's going to have their own forge, their own anvil, and then we're going to have every two teams sharing one post vise. So that's kind of what the workstations are going to be like. And then, yeah, you got 4 hours to do whatever kind of work you can. And then we have cash prizes. So first place is going to get $1,000. Second place is going to get $600. And then third place is getting $400, and it's only $100 to enter. So it should be really fun, man. That's what I'm really excited about, is watching other people, you know, push themselves and work together to forge something cool. You know, it should be cool to watch. It should be cool to participate in. I'm really, really excited about it.
Yeah, dude, this sounds like a blast. I have had a strong interest in creating an event like this for our local guild in the past. We're somewhat of a new guild, and COVID really messed up the way we played with things. I know it messed with the Banna's plans on one of their big events too, which is really unfortunate. But going forward, things are picking up, and this is one of the things that I'm really interested in, is this idea of a team forging event. Maybe even more than just a forging event, but more like a team building exercise, really in an essence, but to show Smiths that what it means to work as a team. And that's really what I would like to see people get from it, is not this, you know, like, oh, we built something amazing, but what did you get out of this as a team, as working together with other people, you know, understanding how other people work, seeing their influences on steel compared to your influences, and gaining from that, and understanding that, you know, what it takes to move around other people in the shop. Maybe these people don't have that wherever they come from. They're solo blacksmiths, or, you know, oh, they've worked with one other person before. Working in a team of four people can really teach you a lot of things. You also brought up this idea of how to keep it fair. And so one of the things I question about that, because this is one of the things that in my mind I had this idea, okay, yeah, you set up stations that you're talking about, but you supply each station with exactly the same steel, or you supply a central pile of steel and each station is allowed to pick whatever they want from that pile. I like the weight ratio. Like, obviously I'm talking about something different than you're talking about. You've got plans. What are your plans? How are you guys doing it when it comes?
Yeah. So we are kind of doing it like that. So we're going to have kind of the central steel pile kind of idea, where everybody's supposed to kind of cut the, you know, take whatever they're going to use to forge, and cut it and have it prepped before their official start time. And so that's good. So everybody kind of has access to the same amount of steel, and they can cut and have that ready to go before they actually start forging. And then all of the kind of different workstations will all be equipped with all the same tools. So the only kind of wild card is really what you're going to bring on your own. And something that we just added, and I don't know if we've published this yet, but we've just added where you can bring one hammer that does not count towards your total team weight. Mm-hmm. So that weight limit came from, you know, we have people that are going to be really close to Johnstown within, you know, an hour or less drive. And there are people that are flying from all over literally the world, mm-hmm. To compete. And so for people that are flying in, you know, they're not going to be able to bring an anvil or a swage block or, you know, big complicated tools. And also, you know, we really like trying to keep it as pure as possible, you know, where it's not going to be super tool heavy. The idea is to try to have everybody, you know, forge, you know, similar stuff with similar tools. So it's not all about, oh, well, I made all these special tools to make this really cool thing really quickly. Again, trying to keep it as fair as possible. But, you know, somebody could bring a 30-pound hammer if they wanted to. It wouldn't count towards their total team weight. But, you know, we really put that into place. So if people have, you know, most blacksmiths have their favorite hammer, you know, or a favorite couple of hammers. So one of those won't count towards their total team weight. So if you have four members, yeah, you basically get to bring four hammers, you know, that's not going to take up that 20-pound limit. So you can use the 20 pounds for, you know, bringing files or hardy tools or whatever else you'd like to bring. That's the idea behind all that.
Oh, nice. I like it. And do you guys have a limitation as to how many stations there are going to be set up? Or are you trying to plan for just as many as possible?
Yeah, the idea is to try to organize it so that we're going to have two teams kind of under one canopy. And so those canopies are going to hold two teams together. So they're each going to have their own forge, their own anvil, and then that post vise is going to be in the middle. So they're going to kind of share that post vise. But then that workstation, that canopy, we're going to have, I believe, five of those. So we can have up to eight people or eight teams, I should say, all forging all at the same time. So it should be a blast, man. And it's something that, yeah, it'd be really fun if you've never worked either striking for somebody or working with a striker. I think that's going to be really fun for people.
Yeah.
And like you said, you know, have, you know, some people are putting steel in the forge, some people are taking it out, some people are going to be at the post vice, other people are going to be at the anvil. It's going to be exciting for sure.
Yeah, I remember one of my first times having kind of a bit of a team forging experience was with Matt Jenkins. There was a night market going on here in Winnipeg, and Matt was doing a demonstration right down by the river. He had this forge set up. Him and Rudy were down there. They had it kind of corralled off, and there was a few other people that had forges there that were forging in the background of him. But he was doing a main bench sculpture, essentially, what he was doing, and he was taking 2-inch square bar and tapering it down to, I think, 1 inch at the very end of it. And he was getting me to help strike for that. And dude, what an amazing feeling. Not number one, getting to work with Matt Jenkins. Hello, isn't that awesome? Right? But
yeah,
striking on something that large was very, very, like, it was different for me. It was something I had never worked on something that large before. And the precision of watching him, how he worked so precise with each blow of the, with each lay of the flatter and making sure that I was hitting it properly. It was a great educational experience. So I love the team forging aspects, man. There's something to it, man, that you just, I don't know. It's fun. A lot of fun.
It is. It's really fun. You know, it's fun blacksmithing, but you have somebody there to do it with or to share it with. It just makes it better. You know, like it's fine going to see a movie by yourself or going out to dinner by yourself. But yeah, you go out with a few friends to a movie or a few friends to go have some food. And yeah, it's just better. I don't know. There's something about it that's really fun.
Yeah. Well, one of the last blacksmithing get-togethers we had, last hammer-ins that we had for the Manitoba Blacksmith Guild, there was three of us doing a striking circle. And I mean, I've seen circles with like eight guys before, but even three of us, and we were like, okay, you gotta make sure you time this right, man.
Right.
And it's
that rhythm.
Yeah, it's fun. So people that are interested in this, look forward to this event. This portion of the event, this will be fun. I highly recommend you sign up for the team forging exercise. You could win $1,000. That is freaking awesome, right?
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, dude, okay. You yourself, you run Fire Iron Forge, doing classes of all sorts. Like you're doing knife making classes, you're doing sculpture classes, you're doing traditional blacksmithing classes. What is it that like really turns your crank when it comes to like being a teacher? What is it, dude? Like there's got to be something that's like, this is what it is. I gotta wonder, man, what is it that being a teacher really gets you going?
Sure. Yeah. Man, there's a lot, you know, with teaching. You have, you know, people from all different skill sets and different giftings. You know, there's some people that when they come to the anvil and they come to work and to learn, you know, they naturally kind of have an understanding as far as how the steel can move and how to kind of manipulate it. And other people, it takes them a while to kind of figure that out. But one of my favorite things when teaching comes from when a student is really struggling. You know, they're really having a hard time. You know, we're trying to get some good fundamentals in or something like that. And they're just, you know, they've already done it a few times and they're booking it up and they're not quite there yet. And they're getting frustrated. And honestly, they're starting to get discouraged. And one of my favorite things is that moment, because as a teacher, like, I know the mountain that they're climbing, mm-hmm. and I know how close they are to the top, and they don't, you know, they feel like they're in the pit. They're still down in the valley. And it's like, man, like you're so close. You're so close, you know, to that aha moment where it clicks and then they do get it. And then when they're on the peak of that mountain, you know, knowing and anticipating land, like I know how close you are, you know, but they don't yet. You know, so there's that moment of frustration and, you know, trying to push through it and, you know, maybe this isn't for me and maybe I can't figure it out. And what am I doing taking these classes and, you know, or whatever. Like we all have those moments when we're learning something new.
Oh, yeah.
So as an instructor, you know, to help and encourage them, to keep going. You know, hey, try this a little bit, try that a little different, you know, try this technique a little bit better. Hey, let me watch you a little closer and let's see, you know, hammer at this angle a little different or bend it this way, you know, and keep at it. And then they have that moment. It's a very specific moment where it's like, dude, now I get it, you know, and I did it. And it's that moment of, you know, accomplishment and really achieving it. That's one of the things that I really love about the ABANA curriculum. That's primarily what we teach.
Okay.
Is the ABANA national curriculum, at least for people that really want to learn how to forge. Like, we have a bunch of one-time classes people can come to and learn how to make a knife, make an axe, make a sword, make, you know, a thing, a fire poker, dinner bell, you name it. But the people that really want to learn how to forge, that curriculum that ABANA has put together from the CBA, the California Blacksmith Association, is just fantastic. You know, like when I was learning how to forge myself, that was something that I was really frustrated with. All the classes and all the things that I was looking for were that. They were all project classes. You know, it's come learn how to make a hook, make a coat hanger, make, you know, make a thing, all of which is fine. But what I was really looking for was learning skill. You know, how do I make clean tapers? How do I punch clean holes? How do I drift eyes? How do I make, you know, certain, manipulate the steel, you know, specifically.
Furthermore to that, how do you know once you've reached what is proper too?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just everything on that whole spectrum. And everything that I looked for, at least at the time, all the classes were, learn how to make an item, not necessarily a skill-focused thing. And so what I ended up doing, I had a bunch of rebar on that stupid railroad track anvil that I was using. And I thought, well, I can practice this. I can practice taking that round, bumpy, you know, piece of rebar and then just trying to forge square. And I'll just try to forge it as perfectly square as I can and, you know, measure it out. I got a little pair of calipers or dividers, you know, to go, okay, I want to make this exactly half inch square. And then once I could do that, then I was like, all right, let me see how long I can make this. You know, I want to try to make it, you know, 6 inches long and have it be perfectly square, no twists, exactly, you know, like it came from the factory. And then after that, it was like, all right, well, let me see if I can do it at 8 inches or 12. And I got to where I could do it for whatever length that I needed to with no twist or anything. And it was dead on. And I loved that because it was like, okay, I feel like my skill is developing as a blacksmith, not just necessarily I'm making stuff to sell. And that's really what I was craving when I was first learning. And as I kind of got to a place where I could make round square for whatever length I wanted, for whatever size that I needed, it sent me back online, you know, to those forums, and somebody got me connected with the CBA, the California Blacksmith Association. And that's where I found a curriculum. And the curriculum there, it was like that first moment where I first got that coal forge, or the first time I was using the weed burner, or the first time as a kid. You know, it's that same kind of magical moment of, man, this is it. This is exactly what I'm looking for. It was very methodical and stepped out as far as how it was portrayed. It was very specific, you know, where every level of the curriculum itself, you know, was designed very meticulously to go, okay, we want to make things just a challenging enough that you're going to grow, but not so challenging that you're not going to be able to do it or not going to be able to do a very good job. Yeah. And so I just fell in love with that. I was so thankful for that. And then shortly thereafter, ABANA adopted that curriculum and made some tweaks and things like that to kind of bolster it a little bit more. And it's one of my favorite things to teach because for me personally, it was it had such a huge impact on my skill level as a blacksmith. It was exactly what I was looking for. What it has allowed me to do as a blacksmith is having those fundamental skills. It's allowed me to imagine something or see something in real life, whether it's ironwork or clay or a wood sculpture or anything. And then I can work out, hey, how would I do this in steel?
Right. Reverse engineer it.
Exactly. How would I? Okay, I'd punch that here, drift that, you know, draw this section out here, all of that kind of stuff, and then do it. Like there's a, one of my favorite things that I've made in the last few years is this bird. It's a really pretty bird. It's on our Instagram if anybody wants to see it. But it's literally the first time I've ever sculpted a bird, ever. It was out of 1-inch round bar, and it looks really good. I'm really proud of it. But it's the first time I've ever made anything like that. But I was able to do that because I have a good understanding of the fundamentals of blacksmithing and how the steel moves and how to manipulate it to get it to kind of do what it is I'm trying to get it to do. So I just, I love all of that. And so that's one of the things I really love about teaching.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so you brought up the Abana curriculum being something that's just, it's fairly new to Abana. And I can't remember how long ago it's, was it 3 years ago probably that they adopted it?
Yeah, about that. Yeah, right. That sounds about right.
And through the CBA, it was Mark Asbury was one of the main proponents of the curriculum. And you can get a lot of like he's got the three books that do the curriculum, right?
He does, yeah. He has three books, and he's coming out with a fourth and a fifth book.
Oh, no way.
Year. Really? Yeah, he's literally been chipping away at those the last couple of years.
Well, that answers that question.
Yeah.
I was going to say, so there's three levels to the curriculum right now. Do you know if there's going to be any sort of additional curriculum work to that? So that answers that question, four and five, which is amazing because obviously, three is not blacksmithing in a bucket there, right? There's a lot more to it than three levels in a curriculum. But it's awesome that Abana's adopted this. And I got to wonder, and it has actually come up in a previous episode, what does that actually do for somebody other than just, you know, obviously gaining the skills is amazing. But do they gain a certificate, a paper certificate from doing all three of those? Is that something that you can write into a band and be like, and prove to them in some sort of way, like, I've completed all three levels, these are my pieces, you know, my grills from each level? I think it's a grill you've got to do for each level, right?
Almost. So yeah. So each level has its own certification. So for most people, the level one is very sufficient. And really for even people that have been forging a long time, I've taken people that are better blacksmiths than I am through the level one. If you guys are familiar with Josh Weston, I just flew out there to Michigan to take him and a team of his employees through the level one. We did like a 5-day crash course intensive all the way through the level one. And Josh is a fantastic blacksmith and bladesmith. And he learned quite a bit, you know, the meticulousness of how everything is thought through and progresses is really good. You know, like, yeah, I think most people that have been blacksmithing for a while, if they go through the level one, you know, they're going to know probably 80% of the stuff that's in there. But that other 20% that they're going to take away is by far worth going through it. There's little gaps in everybody's learning typically.
Yeah. The 20-80 rule, dude.
Yeah, it's gonna help fill those in. So the when you complete the level one, you get a certification. The level two, you get a certification, and then the level three. So the final project for the level one is a very specific gate latch where it's forged. It's a very simple project, but it's all to very specific dimensions, which is really the big test there. And all of the things that you learn throughout the level one all give you the skills and all of the tools needed to make that specific gate latch.
Oh, nice.
And then the level two just builds on that. So the level two goes mostly into more advanced forge welding, and then also lots of you know, scroll work and kind of how all that looks. And then level three is like the level two just on steroids. We take everything and just ramp it up to the nth degree. And I really, really like that. After the level three, there's been different things that Abana has done and the CBA has done. Like they had a repose part of it, and some other like large scale joinery things that they were going to kind of add on. I'm on the education committee for Abana as well. And one of the things that we've been talking about is kind of like add on a la carte type thing. So I think we're going to keep the three levels. And just to clarify, so Mark's fourth and fifth books, I don't think they're going to be curriculum or anything like that. I think they're going to be more project-based books.
Okay.
Because all his other books are more about fundamental skills and that kind of stuff. And if you get those books, which I would highly recommend, at the very least get the first one, the black one with the yellow writing on the front, The Fundamentals of Forging. The new ones I think are going to be more projects to still push yourself as a smith, but how to kind of make those different things. The one of the things we talked about in the education committee, though, at Urbana, is, you know, there's a need for some modern blacksmithing additions as well. Like, there's nothing in any of the curriculum at all that really focuses on how to use a power hammer, how to use a hydraulic press, how to use an induction forge. You know, those kinds of things that, right. Yeah, in the time we now live, yeah, we absolutely want to do the traditional blacksmithing. But at the same time, yeah, people need to know how to run an angle grinder, you know, and how to use a 2x72, you know, stuff like that. So we've talked about maybe doing like a power tool, add-on to the curriculum.
Oh, that'd be beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's lots of stuff, and we've actually talked to Pat Quinn. He's got a fantastic power hammer curriculum.
Yeah.
So he might be working with us on putting something like that together. So yeah, there's one of the things that I really have enjoyed about Urbana and their adaptation and taking on the curriculum from the CBA is that we're always looking at it. You know, we're always trying to keep it updated. We're trying to modify it. About once a year, we'll make tiny little tweaks here and there to go, hey, you know what? I think it would be best if we added this, or, you know what? This seems like it might be redundant. Let's take this out, or let's tweak this here or there. So that way it stays fresh, it stays current, and it stays relevant to what people are doing. By and large, for the levels with the curriculum, we try to keep most of it traditional, with the assumption that most people are not going to have a hydraulic press or a power hammer or that stuff. So almost everything, or I think, yeah, everything you can do with basic tools, with a forge and an anvil. And so that's one of the things I like about it. But yes, you're right. There is a need for some modern equivalent to that as well. But yeah, they get a certification when they complete each level. So that's kind of a cool thing.
And they write into Urbana to get that certification? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So yeah, so when they go through the different levels, if they don't go through it one-on-one with an instructor, there's some Zoom classes that they can go to, or they can go through the whole thing on their own. They just need to get in touch with an instructor, either in person or via email. And then they can, you know, take pictures and video, and they just need a certified instructor that can sign them off. And then once the instructor signs them off, then they're good to go. They have to be an Urbana member to get the certification. But that's really it. So the instructor submits their information, they become a member, and then they get that certificate, which is really cool.
There are a lot of benefits to being an Urbana member. This is one of them. One of the things that I really like about Urbana is the documentation work, the publications that they do. The Anvil's Ring being one of them, right?
Yeah, and the Hammer's Blow.
And the Hammer's Blow, yeah. Thank you. That's the other one. Dude, I cannot get enough of publication work like that. It's simple, to the point. CBA does one as well. If you want to join the CBA, they have a really excellent publication that they do as well. These little things that you get once a month in the mail can really open your eyes as to what's possible as a blacksmith. And it can be a little bit of an enticement too, that, hey, maybe one of these days my work will end up in that magazine. Maybe one of these days Urbana is going to publicate my work. Dude, I have one of my highlights in my blacksmithing with Instagram is Urbana reposting some of my work, or having Blacksmith Life is an Instagram account reposting my work, or having the CWB reposting my work, the Canadian Welding Bureau. Like, dude, oh yes, that feels so good to have people be like, look at this guy, like, wow, what? I love that stuff, man. So big lots of love to Urbana for what they're doing. I highly suggest you head over to urbana.org, sign up as a member, take these perks, soak them up. They're there for the people. Use these perks, man. That's what they're there for. Gain from them. Level up. Level up.
Absolutely.
If I may.
Yeah.
One of the things that's like, if I could wish for anything, a curriculum book from Peter Braspinix. Oh my God.
Oh, dude.
Please, please. That'd be so amazing. Yeah.
It would be.
So, okay, dude. I keep dude this, dude that. The snowboarding years. You were a snowboarder too, which is pretty cool, man. Where did you snowboard? Where were you growing up snowboarding?
So I grew up in Southern California. So we went snowboarding all over the place out there. You know, one of the things, talk about being spoiled earlier, holy smokes. You could go surfing in the morning at the beach and then go snowboarding in the evening, you know, go night snowboarding. But yeah, we would go to all the places in Southern California. So there was Mountain High was a place, and then there's like three different resorts in and around Big Bear. So we go to Snow Summit and Bear Mountain, all those places. Really, really fun.
dreamy, dude. That sounds so amazing. I grew up where I get to ride a ditch with a tow rope on it. It's brutal.
Right on.
But it makes for a good rider. You don't, at the hill that I ride at regularly, you don't have to unstrap. You literally do laps, and it's a three-feature hill. So it's like handrail, jump, handrail, or handrail kind of thing. So it's a fun little hill, man. Definitely, it's where the dude comes from. If anybody wonders why I say it so much, that's where it comes from. But you don't strike me as a snowboarder looking at you right now. You're wearing, like almost what would be described as an Amish outfit, if I may. No offense, but I look at you and I'm like, you are not a snowboarder, dude. Like, where did this – you obviously – have soaked up Idaho, man, right? Is that what's going on here? How long have you been in Idaho for now?
You know, we've only been here about 4 years. But even though I was born in Southern California, you know, I grew up, you know, doing all the skateboarding and for a short period rollerblading. And then, of course, snowboarding and BMXing and mountain biking, all that kind of stuff. But, man, I never felt like I fit there. In a lot of different ways. And so, shortly after we got married, my wife and family and I, we actually moved to Colorado. So we moved to Colorado for about 4 years, which was fantastic. And then we ended up going back to California for some family stuff for a few years before we eventually came up here. But yeah, no, this definitely feels like a place that I fit, you know. I feel a little bit like I've got that old soul mountain man in me a little bit.
Yeah, no, that's what I get from you as a picture, dude. I look at you and I see an old soul mountain man, dude. Like, and you're a blacksmith, so go figure, right?
Sure. It works.
So, what's your shop like, dude? Tell me a little bit about your shop. You've moved here a few years ago. So did you build a new shop? Did you buy a place with a shop?
Yeah. So we've done a couple different things. So when we very first moved out here, we just rented a little house that had a two-car garage. And that's kind of what I was doing the blacksmith stuff out of before. So everything was kind of mobile, you know, like everything was on wheels and carts and stuff like that. So it was like, all right, I'm going to forge, you know, take the cars out of the garage, wheel the stuff out, you know, do some foraging, and then, you know, wait till it cooled down, put it all back, pull the car back in. But when we were going to go purchase a house, my wife likes to do woodworking. And so having some kind of a shop on the property, like, was a deal breaker. Like, we weren't going to buy a place if it didn't have some kind of a shop. So the house we ended up buying a few years ago, it has a 20 by 40 shop on it, nice. Which I'm very thankful and grateful for. I've never had a shop before, and just incredibly blessed and thankful to have that. And, you know, didn't know how to set it up. You know, it was like, I can set everything up and it doesn't have to move, you know, for cars and stuff to go in and out. So we set that all up. She kind of had a woodworking section. I had a blacksmithing section, and we kept all that, clean and safe, because the stuff from the woodworking, not good for sparks and heat a lot of times.
Right.
Yeah, it was a really cool little setup. And then we ran that for, gosh, maybe like 4 months, 5 months, something like that. And then a friend of mine, he's out of a city that's about 45 minutes to an hour from here, Spokane, Washington. And he was kind of the main blacksmith instructor in our area, and he was retiring from blacksmithing. And so me and him got to be pretty good friends. And he goes, "Hey, David," he goes, I know that you love teaching and you're just kind of doing it, you know, occasionally on the side and stuff like that, but you just got that shop and I'm retiring, you know, would you like some students?" You know, and I'm sure that sounds like a blast, you know, absolutely. Let's do that. And so, so we did that for a Saturday and it was bananas, man. I think we had 6 students, which for me was crazy at the time. You know, normally it was me and one, maybe 2 other people, you know, just kind of, you know, showing them how to make different stuff. But this was a lot more formal and organized. And so we started a Facebook page and then, you know, it was like, okay, well, let's try doing this again in a month. We'll do it on another Saturday. And then that blew up. That we had 8 people and we were forging from 8 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock at night.
Beautiful.
The entire day.
I love it.
Knives, we were doing all kinds of stuff. It was super cool. And so the next month we did that same thing, but twice, and same thing from 8 to 8, just packed, you know, tons of people were really interested, which was super cool. And I was thrilled. And so anyhow, so that went on for about 4 or 5 months. And we were making money at it, which was kind of cool. And so I was talking to my wife, cause I was still working as a commercial truck driver at the time. It was just a hobby, as far as forging goes. And so I was talking to her about it and, she's so sweet. I go, "Hey, you know, if I can do this, you know, some stuff during the week, I think I can replace my income, you know, as a truck driver." And she's so sweet. I love her to death. She goes, "Please don't." You know, you're making good money. We know our bills are getting paid, which is great. You know, all the money that's coming in from you doing these classes, you get to just dump it right back into the shop, which is great. You love that. You know, and I go, "Well, you know, we kept talking about it, of course." And I go, "I had some stuff kind of lined up for the summer. You know, there's a North Idaho State Fair and a Ren Fair, a couple other events like that." And I go, "Look, we got these events that kind of might help kind of launch this business. You know, we had already figured out how to get insurance and all that kind of stuff sorted out and waivers and, you know, loads of safety glasses and hearing protection gloves, you know, all that kind of stuff." And I go, "Let's try it. You know, let's try it for the summer and see if we can get the plane off the ground. You know, if we can get it going, then how cool is that? And if not, then no problem. We'll go back to just doing it on the weekends. It'll just be kind of like a side hustle or whatever. That'd be fine. It's not going to be hard for me to go back to driving a truck." So that's what we did. And that was 4 years ago, three and a half years ago was when I started full time. So yeah, it's something that I never thought I would be, a full time blacksmith. But just kind of how the cards fell and how it worked out, and it's been growing. So yeah. So with our shop specifically, so we started out of this little 20x40 shop, and started to outgrow that pretty quickly. But I live in like a residential area, so we don't have like a homeowners association or anything like that. But, I have a neighbor's house that's about 40, 50 feet away from our shop. So it's not too far away, and, you know, we make sure that we're courteous to them and I talk to them and make sure that they're good with everything there. But needless to say, the city didn't like it. So the city said that we couldn't forge there with any commercial blacksmithing. I can still forge there. I can still have friends come over and forge, but nothing commercially. So there's a makerspace at a town called Coeur d'Alene. It's about 25, 30 minutes from us. So the gentleman who retired, Steve, when he retired, he ended up donating his entire blacksmith shop to this makerspace. And so that makerspace was like, "Okay, like, this is awesome. We have all this blacksmith stuff." He had a power hammer, a press, bunch of anvils, forges. I mean, you name it. He had a pretty full shop. So they were very grateful for all of that, but nobody there was a blacksmith. And so Steve got me and them connected. I'm going to go, "Hey, I'm kind of taking over Steve's students. I'd be happy to help you set the shop up. And then I'll teach a couple classes here, just like once a week for a few hours. So that way people can learn how to do it." So I helped build that shop for them and then taught there just one day a week. So when the city came by and was like, "Hey, you can't do your classes and everything here." I talked to them and they let me set everything up there.
Amazing.
So we just moved all of our classes there, which was super cool.
That's awesome, dude.
And then as we continue to grow, a friend of mine who started teaching with us, he runs a shop out of a town called Athol. The name of his shop is Athol Ironworks.
Oh, yeah.
Really great guy. Yep. Will. And so Will goes, hey, man, he goes, you know, we can set up a little shop up here. He goes, I can teach out of it some. You can teach out of it some. Because me and him are like two peas in a pod, man. We both love the same kind of blacksmithing and the same kind of stuff. We both love teaching. And so I was like, all right, absolutely. Let's do that. So we moved kind of more than half of the classes to the Athol shop. And then just recently, just at the end of December, we just purchased a dirt lot in the city of Rathdrum, which is where I live, right on Main Street, where we're going to build a blacksmith shop. So we're going to build a 50 by 50 shop. So it's 2,500 square feet. Oof. Where we're going to build a shop there. And yeah, we're going to keep the shop rocking and rolling with classes with Will at Athol Ironworks, at his shop there. And then we're going to do classes here in Rathdrum at that new shop, which Lord willing will be done this year. And then also the classes we're still doing at that makerspace called Gizmo in Coeur d'Alene. So a few different shops. And then I'm going to have this shop at our house. And I don't know what I'm going to do with that one now. Wow. Once the new one's built.
It looks like
very, very blessed.
Yeah. Sounds like the wife is going to have a full, full shop for her woodworking right away.
Yes, no, I think that's going to be the first thing that probably happens.
That's awesome, dude. Oh, you guys got a wicked setup, man. It sounds like growth is number one in your business right now, that it's doing really good in that aspect. What are some of the other things that you're looking at with your business outside of growing the classes? Or I'm sure you've been kind of caught by surprise running a business, that there's all these things that you don't know what you don't know. What are some of those things that have kind of popped up that you can tell people about that, you know, might be a learning lesson for them?
Yeah, there's a lot, man. The biggest thing that I can say as far as, you know, running a blacksmithing business, especially doing it full time, is something we touched on a little bit earlier, you know, that will to do it, the will to make it happen. That is so huge, because yeah, running a business, just like learning how to forge for the first time, you have to have that desire to do it, to make it happen. That's the kind of entrepreneurial mindset. I came from a family of entrepreneurs. Both my mom and my dad have had different businesses. So I'm very comfortable in that kind of world. My wife was not so much. But the, you know, that will to make it happen, and just, you need to figure out kind of whatever you have to figure out to make it happen and to make it all work, is so huge. That can't be understated, you know. And something that's really helpful for a lot of people, because I teach full time, and the people that I teach, most of them want to be blacksmiths. You know, they want to do this for a living, for a career. And so it's a frequent conversation that I have. And it's something that will serve people well, knowing kind of who they are and what they're good at and what they're not good at. You know, not everybody's good at everything. Mm-hmm. And to run your own blacksmith business, especially as a full-time endeavor, that's a very different animal than just being a blacksmith. You know, there's a lot of blacksmiths that are really heavy artisans. You know, they're really excellent artists. But to try to find an artist that is also a good business person is extremely it is very difficult to find somebody that has, you know, that kind of mindset of, okay, these are my numbers. This is my profit margin. This is kind of where things need to be. This is where I'd like for them to go. This is how we can get there financially, and how we can, you know, sort things out as a business that way and be creative and artistic. And it's not that you need to be that person, but you need to know what kind of person you are so that you can sort that out. Like, I'm certainly not good at a lot of things. But for the things that I'm not good at, man, I have sought after people that are good at it. A great example is through Mark Asbury's book, which the very first one is fantastic. There's a hammer that he uses in some of those photographs. They're black and white pictures, but they're brilliant. And one of the hammers that he uses says Bailey on it. And I go, who's Bailey? I want to find who makes that hammer. That's Mark Asbury's hammer, you know, who makes this? And so I start looking it up, and it's Brent Bailey.
Yeah.
And so brought out Brent and got him on the phone at some point years ago. And me and him just hit it off, man. He's like the older brother I never had. I just talked to him yesterday. We get on really, really well.
That's awesome, dude. But, man,
and a huge, huge help for me in so many different ways, because he's been doing this full time for such a long time. You know, he's been around the block. He's done blacksmithing classes and stuff like that all over the world. You know, he is so much not just a hammer maker. He has done some of the most incredible blacksmithing work I've ever seen. But if you look at his Instagram or you look at his website, a lot of it is mainly hammers. But man, the dude just he's definitely that artistic, creative person. And so people like Brent, people like Mark Asbury have been huge. Through reaching out to people and just trying to get a hold of them and go, hey, you know, how did you sort this out? Like, I remember reaching out to Mark about, you know, waivers and insurance to go, Mark, you know, you're the top dog as far as blacksmith instruction. I'm doing it. But, you know, how did you figure this out? And what do you recommend for this and that? And he came out to teach a class with us this last summer. So I got to spend a lot of one-on-one time with him, which was just absolutely brilliant. It was fantastic and priceless time there with Mark. But we, you know, we had a chance to just talk and spend time with people that that have so much more experience and so much more knowledge. One of the things that that we talk about a lot in class is that you know, to those who remain humble, there's always something to learn, and that is so huge for somebody that wants to do this as a career, or just if they're just getting into blacksmithing, or they want to get into a different part of blacksmithing or bladesmithing. If you keep that spirit of humility, I promise you there's stuff to learn from somebody. Mm-hmm. There's a hammer in that I'm going to be going to with some guys down in Arizona in about a month. I'm super, super excited about. And it's all bladesmithing, you know, like it's all going to be a lot of grinding and stuff like that. And, you know, forging integral bevels and things like that, all stuff that's really not in my wheelhouse. But I'm super pumped to go because of that exact thing.
Right.
You know, being around, you know, and connecting with other people that know different things than you do, and having the humility to go, okay, well, what can I learn from this person? Mm-hmm. You know, and even, you know, local small businesses, like I've talked to all kinds of people, especially with building the shop. I've never built a shop before,
right.
You know? So it's like, hey man, teach me about concrete. You know, what's a good PSI rating to have?
And my massage, you know, therapist freaking taught me shit about business, dude.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's true, man. There's always stuff to learn if you have that kind of mentality. And one of the things that I've been really blessed by is the blacksmithing community in general has been very generous, mm-hmm. you know, with their knowledge and understanding. Every once in a while, you'll get somebody that wants to kind of hold their cards close, and they have some trade secret they don't want to share, all of which is okay. But yeah, by and large, yeah, 90% of the time, you know, people are very open and willing. You know, all you have to do is just reach out, you know, and ask some questions and have the humility, you know, don't come into somebody's shop or approach somebody and go, hey, so I'm, you know, this such and such awesome blacksmith, look how great I am. And, you know, you should see how great I am kind of deal. Yeah, and some curiosity, man. And you'd be amazed with the nuggets and priceless help that you can get for all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Hey, do you use linseed oil at all, bud?
Oh, love linseed oil. Absolutely.
Have you heard of the Twiller linseed oil?
No. Boiled linseed oil, yes.
Okay. Well, the Twiller is the name of a company that they do boiled linseed oil. But the Twiller is a company out of Saskatchewan up here in Canada. It's two brothers. They farm the flax. They plant that seed. They farm it. They pull it out of the ground.
No.
And they squish it themselves into oil, bottle it, and they've got a website, thetwiller.com. You can head over to their website. You can use the code ForgeChat10. It'll save you 10% on orders $50 or more. Dude, their oil is food safe. They've got other different, because they're not putting all the stupid additives into it that you get in the store-bought stuff, right?
I can't wait to order some.
Yep. It is amazing stuff.
Yeah, we use that stuff. Gosh, we use that for sure, all of our hammer handles and axe handles.
Yes, I mean, sir.
That's the standard go-to, man. We sand it all down, and once it's all to shape, then, yeah, you put some linseed oil on that puppy, let it really soak in there. That's fantastic. I had no idea.
Yeah, and he's got a couple products where he does an addition of beeswax and another one where he does beeswax and carnauba wax as well. So you can get these little tins of like paste wax that you can add onto stuff for preservation. I like to use it even for the hot oil finish, okay. Right? You know, when you're blackening steel, right? So yeah, twillerlinseed.com. Use that code ForgeChat10. Save yourself 10% on orders $50 or more. Support local. Well, local.
Love it, yeah.
You're not Canadian, so sorry. But hey, you're not far.
We're a few hours away from Canada. We're far north Idaho.
So do you go to the Southern Ohio Hammer and the big one, SOFA?
So that's Ohio. We're in Idaho.
Ah, fuck. Shut up. I am terrible with that, man. That's not the first time I've made that mistake. And you guys aren't Ohio and Idaho are like over, like apart from each other, right?
Yeah, no, they're super far apart. No, in Idaho, we love that because there's a ton of people that want to move here and have been moving here for, especially over the last like 10 years. And so it's the joke locally, you know, where it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, Ohio, it's right over here. Yep, that's where you should go and check out.
Ohio is, if I'm not mistaken, I've driven through Ohio before. It is like flat, right? Farmland.
That's crazy. Yeah. Beautiful trees, though. They have my best friend got married in Ohio, and his wife grew up there. Beautiful trees. I mean, just absolutely gorgeous out there. But yes, I don't think they have any mountains.
So what's Idaho like as far as geography goes?
Oh, Idaho. Well, I hesitate for your listeners here to tell them how wonderful it is. It's terrible. You should not move here. And it's absolutely awful. No, it is majestic and beautiful and amazing. It's you get a lot of trees, a lot of evergreens, a lot of mountains. If you like the outdoors at all, it is like heaven on earth. You know, it reminds me a lot of Colorado, to the places that people didn't quite get to in Colorado, you know, or the more remote places. So you get these beautiful, beautiful, sunrises and sunsets and, you know, real wilderness and all kinds of rivers and lakes. You know, one of the things that's nice is we're not, you know, I'm 30 minutes away from Eastern Washington. So Washington sucks up a lot of the moisture before it gets here. So we still do get some rain and some snow. But, you know, when we were in Colorado, we would get tons of snow and it would get really cold because of the elevation in Colorado. But here it's, as far as winters go, they're not bad. We get some snow. It gets cold. Last month we had some of the coldest temps we had on record. It got down to like negative 12, I think, something like that, which is crazy, crazy low for us. But normally in the wintertime, you know, it hovers around 25 to 35, and it's really not bad. You know, it snows a little bit and sticks in the mountains, and it usually melts in town. And yeah, no, it's absolutely brilliant up here. Loads of water, loads of wild animals if you're into hunting and fishing.
If you don't
like that, then it's not for you, though.
When you were saying temperature, you were saying 35 Celsius?
No, sorry. That's all Fahrenheit.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Celsius. Yeah. 35 Celsius would be
hot. Yeah, that's hot.
That's really hot.
Yeah. It's too hot for me, man. That's for sure. Anything, even 25. And I'm like, nah, you know what? Yeah. I could survive without that ever again. That's about the,
yeah, it's
that's
probably closer to like 15 to 20 Celsius. Oh, this winter dude. Up here, you know, maybe closer to 10. It's pretty moderate, you know. It's not bad at all. It's really nice. We got rivers and lakes. The bad thing about North Idaho is if you don't like outdoorsy stuff. If you don't like hunting, camping, fishing, hiking, backpacking, you know, snowboarding, skiing, snowshoeing, any of that kind of stuff. If you're not into horseback riding and that kind of stuff, then you're going to be miserable here because there's not a lot else to do other than blacksmithing.
People like that exist?
They do, man. We moved away from those people.
What? Come on now. No. no, that sounds terrible. I was like, not even qualifying as hosers. Jeez Louise. Man. Well, okay. We have brushed on all aspects of different things here. We've soaked up a ton of different things. I've got to learn a little bit of who you are and why you do this, which is it's amazing, man. I don't know really what else we can brush on here. Normally, we'd be sitting down with a co-host, Nick Welsh. He's been tied up busy as heck with his business, which is one of the reasons I was really hoping to bring him onto this episode, to see you two guys fire back and forth about how you run your business. I personally don't run a business at the moment. I've wanted to make this a business for a long time, but my full-time job doesn't give me that opportunity, especially like it gave, like what yours did. You were, it's like, well, as a truck driver, it's not hard to walk away from it and come back to
right
almost essentially the exact same job. With my work,
right,
if as a welder, yeah, I can find a job anywhere as a welder, but that changes very much from job to job, you know, going from working in a dingy, dirty shop to working in a really nice shop, or going from having to work extremely hard, lifting heavy steel all day long, for example, and in a steel shop where you're moving big bars of steel all the time, right, to working in a TIG facility where you're doing, you know, TIG welding stainless steel tables all day. The change is so much. The level of safety that you have to go through in one job to another,
sure,
right? And it's something that really scares me, to say, to be honest. It does scare me, the idea, yeah, of leaving my current job to try to take this on as a business, only to find out that you overstepped your boundaries here, buddy. This isn't for you, and having to go back into the, right, workforce and finding that, like, dude, I've been at my job for 15 years now. I've been, yeah, at it for 15 years for a reason, because it's actually a decent job, to say the least, man. Right. I do enjoy, like, and this has come up before on the podcast, I do enjoy my job. There are a lot of things about, sure, my job that I don't enjoy. Just, sure, like everybody else in this world, you're working for somebody else. You're making somebody else rich. I'm leaving home every day, watching my kid. My wife runs her own business. She runs a house cleaning, okay, business. She gets to stay, okay, home and work on the computer and deal with clients throughout the day and make sure the kid, right, gets taken off to school. She's home when the kid gets home from school. Oh, the kid has a day off from school. She gets to be at home with the kid. And I look at the stuff and it's like, I could be doing something similar. I could be the guy in the shop that's like, you know, says goodbye to the kid in the morning when she gets on the bus. I could be home for the kid, right, when she gets home on the bus. I could be home on those days off and still be working at the same time, right? Like, it's,
right,
these things I look at and go, man, I really, really wish I could do it. But then you start to look at the other aspects of business, of dealing with some of those headache clients, having to file, sure, all of your taxes, staying on top of that, being disciplined enough to properly manage those aspects, your paperwork, your bills.
Yeah.
Dude, that stuff is somewhat nightmarish to me, to think about ensuring that, like, clients for sure. That's really on, like, I'm not a people person. With your style of business, you deal with a lot of clients because of classes. You're, yeah, not dealing with one client per project. You're dealing with multiple clients daily that come in and out. What is it? I figured it out. What else we can talk about, because after my rambling here, what is it about dealing with all of these people? What's the key factor to it, man? How do you manage people in your business?
Oh, great question, man. There's a lot to it, you know, because we still do custom iron work for people also. So we're not just a school, like, we're a full service blacksmith shop. So we still do custom iron work and pieces for people all the time. So we do, yeah, we have students and then we have customers. And yeah, we're putting production stuff in place as well. So there's a lot to it. The big thing with running a business you know, it kind of comes back to that knowing yourself. You know, there are some people that are entrepreneurial people. You know, they think like that. They're good with that. They're happy to take on the risk for the potential reward. Knowing that even if it does fail, like, okay, that's fine. Like, I'll run that, let it fail, and then I'll go and do something else, or I'll find a different way to do that next time, or, you know, things like that. As far as the business goes, it's hard. There's, you know, there's a lot that people don't normally think about until they pull that trigger, you know, until they really make that switch. And there's good things about that, and there's bad things about that. You know, working for somebody else is hard. There's a lot of hard things about that. And working for yourself is also hard. It's just a different kind of hard. Mm-hmm. That's all that it is. You know, there are times where I look back and going, oh man, I remember when I just used to work 40 to 50 hours a week. And when I was home, I was 100% home, you know, and I could just be here and be present and all that. You know, one of the things with running your own business, at least most of the time, especially if it's a little small, is you're kind of working all the time. You know, like you always have people sending you emails or social media messages or different appointments or different things going on. You know, you're on the hook for everything. But I like that. You know, I like making it on my own, kind of. You know, that's appealing to me. Mm-hmm. I like the challenge of that. But it is hard because it's like, all right, you get on enough money to pay the month, you know, a month's worth of bills. And then it's like, all right, now do it again, you know, and then do it again. But there's, you know, a handful of things that personally have been interesting to discover for myself with going from doing it as a hobby to being a full-time career has been, you know, blacksmithing was my hobby. You know, like that was my me time. That was my kind of getaway, my escape, my happy place. And that hasn't changed. It still is my happy place. And it still is the place that I go to. Like my birthday is coming up and my wife was going, you know, hey, what do you want to do for your birthday? And I go, really? Like, it's going to sound silly, but I just want to go to the shop. You know, I want to go and, but I just want to go and make whatever I want to make. You know, there's no deadlines. There's no,
I'm with
no
you.
Fires to put out. I just want to go and make whatever I want to make. And that's really it. Like it's pretty simple. But, you know, one of the challenges of doing what you love for a living is that, you know, that can go away if you're not careful. So I set aside specific times like that for like my birthday kind of deal where it's like, hey, once a week I go into the shop just for me. Like, hey, it's not for a client. I'm not going to try to sell this thing. I'm just going to kind of try to make something I've never made before or something I've always wanted to make. The other day I had a chance to make a really cool center punch that I'm super excited about. We haven't published it yet, but it's an idea that I've had for like 2 years of this center punch design. But stuff like that, you know, because it's easy to lose. It's easy just if I don't make time to forge for myself, you just get lost in it, you know, and just go, oh, well, now it's all this thing. And then your thing that was fun becomes a burden. You know, and then it can suck the whole fun out of it. And you're like, why am I even doing this in the first place? So a lot of stuff like that to think about if it's something that you do want to move into full time. Brent and I have talked about this a lot. You know, he took a long time before he was able to go full time. He was like 7 to 10 years, something like that, that he was, you know, doing the blacksmithing thing on the side and then still working a full time job and saving up. And I think he saved up about 10 grand before he was ready to take that leap. And there's some really, really good wisdom in that. We did something similar, you know, where I was like, all right, I'm going to kind of save it up and then really set it up, you know, for success as much as I can tell. And then, yeah, let's give it a shot. But even if it doesn't go, I still had something I could go back to if I really had to. So there's a lot of things like that to talk to, but there's a lot of resources available to people now as far as mentorships for businesses and all that kind of stuff. But again, like you're talking about like, hey, like I don't know how to handle customers super well, or I'm not a big people person. Like that's really fine, I think, especially within the blacksmithing and bladesmithing worlds. You know, a lot of guys are kind of lone rangers and they just kind of like to work on their craft and kind of just be left alone. Like, hey, I just kind of want to make stuff and have people buy it. And that's it. Like, that's all I really want to do. And I think you can absolutely make a full-time living doing just that. Yeah. The challenge is, you know, the person who needs to interact with a customer, that does need to happen. You know, there's got to be some way of sorting that out. But again, if you have that will to make it happen, then you figure that kind of stuff out. You know, okay, so I need somebody else that's gonna sort things out with customers and answer emails and questions and put things on our Etsy or our Facebook or our Instagram or however you're going to sell stuff on your own website and do the search engine optimization and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's fine. You don't have to do it all, you know, and honestly, you shouldn't at some point, you know, at the beginning, sometimes you have to, but as soon as you can, you know, have somebody else that has skills that you don't, then yeah, if you set it up so that you can pay them to utilize their skills, that way they can do what they're good at. You can do what you're good at, you know, and then you really have a much more successful business, or at least the chances are much higher. But it's a risk, man. It's a risk. But it's a risk no matter what to me. You know, it's like if I was working for a company for 15 or 20 years, you know, they could lay me off at any time for the economy. I mean, COVID was insane. That changed a lot of businesses for a lot of people. I mean, anything could happen at any point in time. So to me, the idea of job security is not super stable if I'm working for somebody else or if I'm working for myself. But at least if I'm working for myself, at least I'm the person in charge, you know, like I'm the captain of my own ship. At least I'm not at the whims of somebody else.
You can foresee that layoff coming when you're working for yourself too. Like, oh shit, I'm going to have to lay myself off soon.
For sure, man. It's challenging, but yeah, you know, it's something that, you have to really weigh those risks, you know, the pros and cons, but it's risky either way. You know, there's definitely pros of working for somebody else and there's pros of working for yourself and there's cons to both. But knowing kind of who you are and what you like and what you don't like will make a huge, huge impact in kind of how that works or how it could work. And, you know, it's not always the case where somebody has 10 grand that they saved up. But Brent worked for, 7 or 8 years or something like that to save up that 10 grand to make that leap. You know, and that's what I was talking about with that will to make it happen. You know, dude saved, you know, a couple hundred bucks a month for, you know, almost 10 years to be able to try blacksmithing full time. You know, not everybody has that in them, which again is okay. You know, if people just want to forge and they want to make a living, find another blacksmith business that is running, that, you know, that's working, and then go work for them. That way you still get a little bit of both. You know, you don't have to, you know, do the taxes and take all of the risk of running a whole business and a whole company, but you can still go and do blacksmithing. You know, there's right now I see tons of people that are starting all these little blacksmithing schools. There's all these, you know, blacksmithing classes are everywhere. Yeah. You know, they're popping up all over the place, like all of which is fine. But yeah, there's, you know, there's a lot of opportunity that's out there. If you just wanted to go and just work, you know, you wanted to just go and do production blacksmith work, and the production blacksmith work, some people want to blow their brains out because it just, there's nothing they can think of that's worse than making the same thing over and over and over and over again. And those are the creative artistic people, of which is, again, totally fine. Don't do production blacksmithing. But even for the people that do the production blacksmithing, man, there's so much to learn from doing production blacksmithing.
Oh,
you know, you make the same thing 1,000 times. Holy smokes. The amount of precision that you can, the skill set that you can learn of making that thing as efficiently as humanly possible is outstanding. I mean, what a great way to learn. Even if you just did that for a couple of years, what you would walk away with from doing something like that, it'd be a lot. So there's a knife company that's really, really close to us called Buck Knives. So their main factory is right here in town, and they have a tour and stuff that you can go to. So I went to go see, you know, the tour of this. You know, they sell millions of knives every year, you know. Right. So let's go see the peak of this huge, successful, you know, conglomerate business, this corporation of what was a bladesmith at one time. you know? And it was weird, man. It was really surreal. It was cool to see the efficiency of everything and also like really sad, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, they do they come up with the design and then they just stamp it, you know, out of a big roll of steel. And then it goes in, you know, a person takes it from one machine to another. But by and large, you know, like their logo is an anvil with the letter B in it for Buck. And there's not an anvil in the whole facility. You know, they still do a lot of hand grinding and hand sanding and shaping and hand assembly for a lot of their knives. But yeah, man, if that's really what you want to do, you want to make money at making knives, like, dude, that's how you do it. It's the most efficient way to crank that product out, to be able to make that kind of quantity, to sell it for the price they can sell it for. And make the money.
This falls so much into conjunction with another conversation I was having with somebody recently in regards to coffee scoops and the progression of, there's a lot of blacksmiths right now that are interested in making coffee scoops. And
Derek Melton
came out with the mini swage block that makes it simple to hammer out a little coffee scoop on it. Brian House has been developing a press tool to press out go ahead, Brian. I think it's awesome that you're doing this. I was in the midst of developing something like that for my own personal use. The problem that I came to realize is that it, and no offense to anybody, mostly Brian, you know, I love you, Brian, so fucking much. But when it comes to doing it that simply, you're losing something. You're losing the essence of actually blacksmithing, of handmaking it at that point. And this has come up previously as to what is a handmade object. You know, when you're making something on a hydraulic press, is it losing that aspect of handmade? And I think a lot of it comes down to personal preference and stuff like that. But that's what it felt like to me, watching myself being able to press out the perfect scoop time and time and time again, and so quickly, just bang, 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 and each one is identical, no hammer marks on it, nothing. And I'm just like, this isn't what people want. I mean, maybe it is what people want, but if this is what people want, they can go to Walmart for it, right?
Yeah, no, it's such a fine line to dance. Brent and I have talked about this a lot, because, you know, he cranks out so many hammers. His leaning on a lot of that kind of stuff. And again, I guess I don't want to speak for him. But you know, if you can make it faster and more efficient and sell it, then why would you not do that?
Yeah.
You know, like it depends on what you're doing. You know, if you're running a business, then it's about making money. That's, you know, that's what it is, you know, but again, quality is definitely part of the deal. So, you know, where do you find that line? You know, is it okay to use a propane forge? Is it okay to use coal? Mm-hmm. Should we make charcoal? Mm-hmm. Well, what if I don't make my, what if I, you know, buy charcoal instead of making my own charcoal? Mm-hmm. You know, like, what if I,
what did I do? I didn't mean to open up this can of worms. Shit.
No, it's a huge can.
I know.
Cause you can really go far down that rabbit hole. Like, so one of the guys that had a real good influence on Brent's work is Grant Sarver. I don't know if you're familiar with Grant's work or not. No. He's since passed on, but he was a really, really good blacksmith out of Western Washington. He made tongs 100% forged, no anvil. So he had an upsetting machine that he used with an induction forge and then a mechanical fly press. And he made the tongs that are OCP tongs. Blacksmith's Depot bought his stuff.
Okay, yeah.
So they make the off-centered tongs, that same style. So Grant Sarver is the guy who came up with those. And they never saw a hammer. They never saw an anvil. But they are really good tongs. They're probably the most widely used tongs, at least in the United States. And they're great tongs. And they never saw a hammer or an anvil. And, you know, one of the things that was cool about how Grant made those is that it was just stupid efficient. he was able to crank out tongs so efficiently with the induction forge, the upsetting machine, and then that mechanical fly press with the tooling that he had in there with the dies, is that he was able to make those quality tongs. And dude, when he first started selling them, he was selling for like $20
yeah.
a pop, like less than half.
Okay, so
of what everybody else was paying for.
You're bringing up something that this could be a hot take here, man. But
sure, yeah,
drop forge hammers.
Yeah.
Why not just set up your system to be drop forging hammers versus using the Brian Brazil technique?
Right.
Right? Like, why?
Yeah, no, and it's an excellent question, you know. I think that at the end of the day, you know, every individual needs to sort that out for themselves as far as what they're comfortable with. Like what Britt and I have talked about is like, dude, do whatever you can do. Where you don't feel like you're selling your soul. You know, if you feel like you need to go and smelt your own iron ore in the backyard or whatever, and take that bloom and forge that out into your own iron and then make something from it, like for sure do that. You know, if you want to buy a hammer blank from somebody that sells them where the eye is already punched and you're just going to drift it and, you know, forge it to shape a little bit, you know, on a hydraulic press or some other method, and you still feel good about that, I think all of that's fine so long as you're communicating that with your customer, if you're selling things.
Yeah.
You know, if you communicate that with your customer to go, hey, look, this is mass produced, you know, it was drop forged, but it is drop forged. It's not cast, you know, it's not whatever. We put the handles on by hand. You know, like I look at Gransfors Bjork's axes. Absolutely love their axes. Like we make axes and I buy their axes because I love them so much. And their stuff is, they have that crazy huge, I don't know if it's a press or it's a power hammer, yeah. You know, what it is that they use. But dude, it's for making production axes, but the quality that comes from those axes are really good, you know, and they are done with a lot of machinery. Mm-hmm. And so I think the thing that's important, at least to me with all of this, is clear and honest communication with the customer. You know, be honest about how it's made and what it is, and then price it accordingly. You know, if you're going to have drop forged hammers, don't sell them for freaking $150 as a hand forged hammer.
Well, and I think that's where a lot of this comes into, dude, though, is, and that's, yeah. I think that is really the sole aspect of it, is at what point, and the coffee scoops is a prime example, why is somebody going to spend $50 for a coffee scoop that wasn't hand hammered in a little wooden dish or on the end of a stump, hand hammered with all the hammer marks in it, versus one that was tossed on a hydraulic press and just boom, done, right?
Right.
Like,
I think both are fine.
Both are fine, but as a maker, where do you draw the line on, at this point, I can no longer be calling this a handmade item that I'm selling for $50. At this point, it's a drop forged item that's worth $20.
Yeah, no, I think that that's up to the individual, really. You know, for myself personally, it's all about time and efficiency. If I can make something more efficiently and I invest in the tools and machinery to do that, then the price of that item should reflect, you know, my expertise and the price of the tools to be able to make it more efficient. If somebody wants something made 100% by hand, then we can do that too. And a lot of times with commissioned pieces that we do, we talk to people about that, especially mm-hmm. with like things like swords and axes, because a lot of people want swords and axes. And if they go, well, I want, you know, this or that design, and it's like, okay, well, we need to know, or I need to know, what is it specifically you're going to do with this, you know, and what is it that you're looking for? Yeah. Because yeah, we can take a piece of flat bar, you know, and cut a tang for a sword and grind the whole thing out, not forge it at all, heat treat it, you know, and then put a cross guard and a handle and a pommel on it and have it never be forged at all. It's
maybe,
just ground. It's just
maybe not even heat treat it because they're doing it for one of the pro champagne bottle swords, right? You don't even need to heat treat it. Yeah.
So when we talk to people about stuff like that, that's how I talk to them about it. To go, hey, look, do you want this to be combat ready, or is this for like a Comic-Con or a Renaissance fair, or is it just something that's going to hang on the wall, or the champagne bottle thing?
There's another statement to put to that too, is that everybody wants a sword until they find out how much they're worth.
Right. Absolutely. For sure. And that's, you know, that's what people have, I think, grown accustomed to, with things like, not even Wish, or, what's the other one that's like Wish? Temu, you know, with stuff like that, where it's just like the absolute cheapest Damascus you can ever find anywhere. You know, it's all of which like is fine. Like, I don't have any beefs with that. But
get the full knife set for $200, right? In Damascus.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
The challenge is educating the public about the difference between something that was made that's that quality versus something that that a blacksmith or a bladesmith is going to make by hand in their own shop.
Okay,
it's like we're making Damascus.
But here's another angle on that, is those knives look good. They know how to make good looking knives. The problem with it is they're not using good quality steel. What if they did use good quality steel?
I think that they should.
But if they did, how would we even compete? How the fuck would we even come close to competing if India started using actual good steel in their Damascus? We'd be screwed.
We might be, but I mean, to me, that's part of business, you know. Find a way to make the best thing possible, the most efficient way possible, and then sell it for as much as you can sell it for. You know, not gouge people, but that's the whole idea, is to make things and sell them in a way that you can make a profit, so you can pay your bills and continue to do what it is that you're doing. And if you can find a way to do that, then I think that that's fantastic, so long as you're honest about how it's made. So I usually talk to our customers about it in the terms of building a house. You know, like you have manufactured homes, you know, that's one style of house. And then you have kind of your run-of-the-mill suburb house, you know, where it's like a housing track, you know, where it's like, okay, we have these five different styles of houses and we're building them all throughout this neighborhood. They're just track homes.
Right.
You know, so the mobile or modular house is going to be priced differently than those track homes. And then those track homes are going to be priced differently than a true custom home, where somebody's building something from scratch. Like in the ornamental ironwork world, you know, you have these factories that are cranking out all kinds of basket twists and, you know, cool things for handrails and gates. And really the CNC guys are killing it. You know, they're making great money from just cutting out some really simple design and then just welding it on a gate. Mm-hmm. And people love that crap. They sell so much of that stuff all over the place, and not even for gates and handrails. People just hang that in their house as a silhouette, you know, and it was just CNC plasma cut, you know, a person, you know, ground it down so it doesn't have any sharp edges, you know, they removed the slag, you know, and maybe coated it with something, and that's it. So it's not forged at all. But, you know, those people are making good money at doing that. So I'm not opposed to people making money, and I'm not opposed to people making things efficiently. But when we're looking at different things like that mobile home or modular home versus a track home versus a custom home, the customer, you know, the public, they often are coming to a craftsman going, expecting that model home or the modular, manufactured home price, or maybe a track home price. But what they're really getting is that custom home, you know, that custom home build. You know, or they don't understand, like, hey, this is 1-inch thick steel that I'm going to forge down by hand with a hammer when it's hot, you know, to make whatever it is that you want to make. I don't have a big stamp press or whatever, you know, that's going to crank it out like Buck Knives. So I can't make a knife for you for $30. You know, I can't make you a folder knife for $30. You know, I can make you a folder knife for $150, you know, and even then it's probably not going to be super special or fancy because of the amount of time that it takes. But clearly communicating that to the public, I think, is our biggest advocate or our big, the best thing that we can do, just because we're talking about and comparing very different things. You know, we're talking about mass production of certain things and then somewhere in the middle versus also something that's created individually, one at a time, by hand, by an individual. And whether you're doing it by hand, you know, with some tooling at an anvil, or whether you did it in a hydraulic press or a power hammer, I don't think that that matters a whole lot because it was still made by hand. It was still assembled by hand, but it is going to have a different look and it's going to have a different feel, and the quality will reflect all of that. And so that's, I don't know, that's kind of my take on all that. I know we're in a bit of a rabbit hole.
No. Well, one of the things you brought up there though is the idea of buck knives, and like, you know, you're like, oh, well, I can just get this $30 knife from Buck Knives. You know, why can't you make a knife that's $30? And it's like, well, I hand make my knives. There's a lot more to it. I don't just throw my knife in a press and it's slapped out, right? Like, I have to do this. But on the consumer level, there's the people that want that, right? They don't want that 30 knife specifically because they want that knife that's not the same as everyone else's knife. They want that unique knife, right? That there is only one of this knife, and because there's only one, I'm willing to spend that extra higher price point. And this is where it falls back to the coffee scoops again. My apologies for really leaning on this heavily, but it's something that I take to heart. Because it's something that I was working on as well. When your coffee scoops, and when each one looks exactly the same as the other one, have you put yourself in a position to take yourself away from that customer point where they got a special item? They got that special item because it's different than all the other ones, right? Have you taken that away because now you're pressing every scoop out exactly the same? Have you shot yourself?
I don't think so.
No? Okay.
Yeah, I don't think that you lose that. I mean, it's going to be different. I mean, a coffee scoop that is made, you know, with dyes and a press is definitely going to look very different and feel very different than something that was done by hand.
Right.
But again, we're going back to kind of what do people want? You know, Walmart and Amazon are making buckets of cash by selling cheap garbage. And so a lot of people don't want to do that. They want to have something else. So that scoop that was still made by hand in a hydraulic press that is, you know, identical or close enough to call it identical, you know, to all the other ones that same maker is making, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because the quality of that scoop is still going to be fantastic. I mean, it is going to be miles ahead of anything they're going to find in a store or anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Is it going to have the same aesthetic as something that was done by hand at an anvil? Definitely not. But I think that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, what that's going to allow them to do is, one, have consistency in their product, you know, which is good for that maker, you know, so that way when they have a picture of a coffee scoop on their website, you know, to go, hey, this is what you're going to get. And it is made by hand, so it's not going to be 100%, but it's going to be 98%, mm-hmm. you know, the same as this thing here, of setting up that expectation and what the people are going to receive for the price. And it lets the maker sell it at a price where hopefully they can price that low enough that they can sell more of them, which I think is good for the maker.
Yep.
And I think it's good for the consumer.
Yep.
And the person that's still knocking it out by hand with a wood stump, with a ball peen hammer, you know, or what have you. I think they should still keep going with theirs as well. But yeah, they're going to have to charge a little bit more because it's made differently. It takes a little bit longer. And I think that has value too. It'll just attract two different people. You know, you're going to get people that go, hey, I really want something that is really, that's the custom home option.
Yeah.
The stuff, you know, the tooling with the fly press or the hydraulic press, you know, with the coffee scoop, that's going to be your track home, you know, to go, hey.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
it's not just a mass produced thing. It's a weird kind of in between place, but yeah, absolutely. I want makers to make money. I want consumers to get high quality goods received, you know. I think there's pros and cons to both. Where it really goes wrong for me is when you have somebody that's doing something like the hydraulic press, you know, or like the buck knives kind of thing, where to go, okay, I'm going to charge, let's say that $50 is the average price for a coffee scoop. I have no idea what they are.
That's I have no idea. Yeah, that's a number I threw out. Sorry.
Yeah, let's say it's $50 just for the sake of the discussion. So that's your average scoop for coffee, or the average price for coffee scoops across the board. So if somebody's going to make one, one at a time, by hand, you know, where it's hand hammered on a stump, you know, hopefully they can charge $80 for their scoop because each one is unique. Everyone is absolutely hand forged by hand, one at a time. And I think that that's brilliant. And my hope is that if they're doing it by hand, they can charge $80 for that scoop. And the person who gets the dies, invests in the tooling and everything that's needed to crank out the quantity of scoops that's needed for them to pay for all of that tooling and for their shop and for everything else, I hope they can sell those scoops for $30 a piece. And the person that's able to sell them for $30 a piece, you know, they're going to be able to sell 100, as where the other person's only going to be able to sell, you know, maybe 40, you know, or something like that. So dollar-wise, it's all probably dollar to time. Wise, it's all probably about the same in the end. But yeah, the communication as far as how it was made is important. What bothers me personally is when you have somebody that's doing the stuff where it's kind of more of a mass production type thing, or they're doing a run, you know, of 500 of a piece or something like that. And then they're selling it for that $80 price.
Right.
You know, you see that a lot on Etsy now.
Yeah.
You know, they go, oh,
yeah.
This is all
handmade bespoke items,
blah 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 blah, and it's really not, you know, it's really manufactured. So the price needs to reflect the time and the energy that was put into the piece. But I think both people can do it and make money, and I think that's great. And both way, consumers can get good things. You know, I want the consumers to be happy and the makers to be happy. That's critical to me. And as long as everybody's honest about it, I think that can still happen.
Yeah. And it falls back on that point you made earlier about running a business or working for somebody else. Both can suck. Working for somebody else can suck. Working for yourself can suck. Hand making a coffee scoop on a wooden stump can suck. Making one on a hydraulic press can suck. It all depends on the eye of the beholder. And it comes down to the Buddha mantra that life is suffering. Choose your path, because no matter what you do, there's going to be suffering attached to it. Choose the one that you want. Choose your suffering, right?
Right. Well, and really, even with the coffee scoop example, you know, there's nothing preventing one maker from having the dies and the tooling to do the hydraulic press option. And also doing it by hand, no problem.
Uh-huh.
If you want a coffee scoop, you know, this is kind of our commercially production made one. That one's only $30. If you want me to do it by hand, then yeah, then that's $80 because it's going to take me an hour instead of 15 minutes.
I like it, buddy.
You know, so what's going to prevent people from doing both? Yeah. You know, makers make, you know, that's, that's my hope.
Yeah. No, I think that's, that pretty much puts it into a good perspective for me, and is this idea of realizing that neither are wrong, neither are right. Both are totally acceptable. It really comes down to consumer choice, comes down to maker choice. You can do whatever the fuck you want to. I'm not here to tell you what to do. That's up to you to decide to do what you want to do. And in the long run, it's up to the customer to decide whether or not they want to buy it from you. Heaven forbid you listen to anything I ever say, because what do I know? I'm here to throw out a couple tidbits of information and talk to somebody and get their side of the story too. And you can take both of our sides of things, put it together, and hopefully develop your own story that you want to attach yourself to. And on that note, thank you very much for joining Forge Side Chat. We're going to call her quits here with a good old coo-roo-coo-coo-coo-coo-coo. David, I know you probably have no idea what the hell I'm talking about, right?
I really don't.
No, okay, Bob and Doug McKenzie, man. If you have any interest to know what I'm talking about when it comes to the Karukaku, Bob and Doug McKenzie were two Canadian comedians that were part of SCTV back in the 80s. They had to do a little Canadian corner thing is what they had to do, where they did 2 minutes of Canadian content, and they opened and closed their little Canadian corner with a good old coo-roo-coo-coo-coo-coo-coo. And That's okay. How we end our show. So thank you and good day.
Cool.
Yeah. Other than that, man, thanks again, David. And excellent, excellent chat, man. Lots of stuff in here for people to soak up. So I appreciate it, man.
Oh, good. Yeah. Thanks for having me. And yeah, if you ever want to do another one, let me know. I'd love to talk with Nick or talk about more of any of the stuff that we talked about today. It was fun, man.
Yeah. No, I appreciate it, man. You got some deep insight, dude. I think we're on a very good level as far as understanding that kind of stuff together and being able to shoot back and forth about it. So it was great, man. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, man. Have a good night.
You too. Cheers.